Hello and welcome to Remainders, the podcast that brings you the movies. We talk about all the good ones, all the stuff that we missed, all the good stuff that we just want to watch again. Joining me is my co-host, my Chicago counterpart, Patrick McIntyre. Pat, say hello to the fine people out there listening to our podcast.
Oh, how's everybody doing today? Good to see you, buddy. Good to see your face always. Always looking forward to the new pieces of art you got going on in your background.
Well, I'll tell you right now, anybody who's watching this, you can't see the art, but I usually do have a lot of the art that I'm doing in my in the background. However, this isn't my art this time. This is my drummer's art that I'm holding for him. I had to pick up from an art show we did in San Bernardino. So behind me is Tom Higginson's art, at Tom is an artist, and I'm showcasing that for him. He can thank me later. I'm sure he never even listens to our podcast, but yeah.
Well, I know he's a Ramones fan, so if we do some more Ramones talk, we could probably do a little bit of that. Yeah, I definitely recognize it. I've seen it on his Instagram. He's definitely got a fucking cool style. I definitely dig it. Yeah.
I mean, it's cool. It's like, I told him the other day that, you know, he just started painting because he's a collector of art and he loves art, you know, just like all of us. He's like, why not? I should just try to see if I can paint. And I always looked at it through the lens of like, okay, like your yo-yo who's painting all of a sudden because, you know, everybody else is. And then one day I kind of looked at it and I'm like, well, wait a second. If I can remove myself from being friends with him and like, look at this, it's like, let's say this was hanging up at like one of your favorite clubs or something.
Right.
Yeah. Damn, this is fucking cool, you know? So like one day when I did that and I stepped away from it, and I could picture this without him attached to it. I was like, he's a pretty good artist, you know?
Hell yeah. Love it.
But today, other than art, which we talk about all the time, we are going to talk about a movie. This is a double feature, a Brian De Palma double feature. And
your favorite.
Yeah, I'm not sure if anybody has checked out our last episode. It was on the movie Blowout, which this is another movie that starts with B. It's Body Double. I don't know if it's the movie that followed up, because I know like there was Scarface in there, right? So Blowout, I believe, was a lot earlier than Body Double. Not a lot, but definitely by a few years. Because
just a couple of years, here,
yeah. Yeah, in between here, De Palma was doing some pretty big movies that he's remembered for. I would venture to say that Blowout and Body Double aren't the top movies that come to mind for most people when they think of Brian De Palma, but we are covering both of those movies. So if you haven't heard our episode on Blowout, you can go back and listen to that. But today we're talking about Body Double, which I do think that this is a good double feature. I think these movies both are pretty good homages to Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, this one especially, and I'm sure we'll get into that in a minute. But Body Double is basically a softcore porno. And, you know, it is actually, I think the buzz thing that's going on right now is a lot of people are talking about erotic thrillers. It seems to be like what everybody is like curating. I'm seeing a lot of places out here in Los Angeles curating their programming for erotic thrillers. And I know Criterion released this film on an erotic thriller programming as well. And that's pretty great because it allowed us to add it into our queue to talk about. But yeah, this is very, very edgy as far as it is borderline softcore porn at times with the amount of nudity that's in it. But it's also, like we said, very Hitchcock in the way that it deals with voyeurism. And it deals with a kind of everyman character that is a struggling actor in Hollywood who gets cheated on by his girlfriend, goes out and kind of falls into and is manipulated into sort of a place to stay where he can overlook a female that happens to get undressed every night and do a dance that he's entranced by, which leads to all sorts of bad things in his life. And we'll get into that in a minute. But I really feel that this film is excellent. However, there are a lot of things that we can pick apart. And I believe that has to do more so with the time that it was released. I would think that this is more of a cult classic nowadays, considered that, than it is a great movie. However, like we could talk about it, but I feel like there's certain things that could have happened in this film that could have made it a great movie. So Pat, I'd like to turn it over to you and hear your initial first thoughts on Body Double. First, have you ever seen this film before?
Okay. Yeah. So this was the first time watching it, actually. And I text you, I was actually, when we were discussing it, on the last podcast, I was definitely confusing it with Body Heat.
Right.
Which is, I just looked up, it was like, it just a year or two before 1981 with William Holden. It just based off the name, I had seen most of that like years ago. And when I, and so I was for a moment confusing the two movies, which I don't think is that crazy based on the title and kind of the premise, just the looks of it in the early 80s vibe.
Yeah, so, I've never seen that film, but I know it is included in the same like Criterion. Like
it's on Criterion too, so it certainly wasn't any throwaway movie at all. Oh, and remind me later, we got Criterion updates to go over. So once we get through this to the other stuff. No, I was blown away by this movie. This is fantastic. You know, every time, and we were just discussing it last time with when we were going deeper into De Palma's filmography, it's like every time I see a new one of his movies, it's like, yeah, I understand why among cinephiles he's viewed as one of the great directors in modern cinema. It really was the horror vibes that certainly got me hooked first in the movie. I mean, it starts off with that great scene where Sam Wesser is playing a vampire and is experiencing a little bit of claustrophobia in the coffin. And then it just kind of keeps on going. It definitely seems like the most Hitchcock movie of his. From what I've seen of De Palma, this one seems like it's up there as like the most jerking off to Hitchcock that he is going to get to.
1,000%.
Yeah, and that's again why it was like one of my favorites. And I do think it is among movie fans and De Palma fans, I think it is seen as certainly a top three for him. I think I looked just vaguely, I've been kind of always bruising like people ranking their De Palma, and it obviously varies like a lot, like more than most directors, but this one was consistently at the top, or at least the top half of most people's lists. So there's definitely a sense of that, but yeah, it's certainly not that popular. It's certainly a cult classic. Like this is not like one that is like all over the place. It's not talked about too much on you know, like through YouTube and covering people covering videos of it. So that's kind of more of like a contemporary survey of like how popular movies are in the zeitgeist. But this one seems kind of like in the middle with that. And yeah, I mean, I was just kind of blown away by like the stylized aspect of a mystery. So mysteries are not normally my jam, and it's largely because they're so plot driven, which I, more than most people, I think plot is about as disposable as you can get in film, as in just not, it's not the most essential part, but it's the aesthetics, everything around it that make a great movie, and the characters and the story within it. So the plot within this, we're going spoilers.
I believe so. 84, so, you know.
Well, definitely. But well, largely because this movie is like so plot driven, like I said. So like discussing everything, like in the second half, will definitely be giving everything away. Everything that De Palma built around the plot, I fucking loved. His aesthetics are fantastic.
Yeah, I so the plot basically is Vertigo, right? I mean, we're talking about like a character who's obsessed with a woman that gets him in, you know, trouble, and he kind of goes manic and crazy because of it. And there's, you know, twists and turns. And I think the plot is nice for the voyeurism in general, for the audience and the character, you know, to kind of live vicariously through this character of Jake Scully is his name, played by Craig Wasson. So like Craig Wasson as an actor, had you seen him in anything before this Craig film? Wasson.
I said Sam Wasson.
Yeah. So yeah, that's okay.
But whoever that is, maybe Sam Wasson. So I was watching half the movie, knowing I had seen him in something. Like there was something that I was like, I've seen this guy up close in something either recently or a long time ago. And finally, halfway through it, I just looked it up. And he was in Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. He's a major part in that movie. So that's definitely what I know him very well from. I believe he's the psychiatrist, which is actually up there. The third one, Dream Warriors, is up there with the original. Certainly the most entertaining Nightmare on Elm Street.
Well, okay, yeah, for sure. And I remember him from that. But in general, like, this is a weird pick for a lead actor for a Brian De Palma film, especially after.
Yeah, he was kind of a, I mean, he certainly wasn't a famous facer at all. So,
well, like, think about it. Like, if we're talking about that, he's already done Scarface and he's already done Blowout, you know, working with John Travolta and stuff like that. I mean, that's why I think this is a great double feature, because we're kind of dealing with a character in the main lead that is like all of us, a little bit more, you know, normal everyday Joe who kind of works a normal job that isn't some sort of, you know, person who you can really not relate to, like some kind of rich guy or something like that. This is somebody who's like in our level, you know, and so you can see yourself possibly getting caught up in all of these insane sort of twists and turns that these characters do. And I think maybe more so than Travolta, you relate a little bit more to Jake Scully. I mean, he's an actor in Hollywood trying to make it. And the first scene, he walks in on his girlfriend who's cheating on him. And there's that really crazy, like, stare down that they do where she kind of like doesn't even care that she got caught, you know, like you can see that, like, he just is kind of a loser, you know? And that's the bummer, I think, for the character and why he gets into such like a predicament is because he is vulnerable. He's got this also thing, just like in Vertigo, Jimmy Stewart has this traumatic experience that happens to him and he causes him to have vertigo, which, you know, means he can't go certain places and like find out like the real full story of what's happening to him. And so that kind of happens with this lead, the character as well, is that because he's kind of has this phobia or something of like tunnels and enclosed spaces, it really gets in the way of him moving forward in different things. We see it in the scene where he tries to get the purse from the guy who snatches it and different things like that. And especially in that first scene where he is the vampire. And he kind of loses his job because of that. So he's got a lot of flaws, just like all of us do. He's been cheated on by his girlfriend, which most of us usually in this life at some point or another, you know, have been cheated on by a significant other. So we kind of all relate to it already. And that's the thing about this character. I don't think he's a great actor or a great choice for a lead. But then I backed up a little bit. I was like, well, maybe he's perfect because we're kind of like, don't really love him because he kind of reminds of us of ourselves a little bit.
Yeah, a lot there. Or I'll start. Plot wise, I mean, you'll definitely be able to tell me a little bit more. I mean, I saw a lot of Rear Window in this, right?
For sure.
Okay, but because you said the plot was mostly exactly like Vertigo, which I'm sure is right. It's been a minute since I've watched Vertigo, so like beat for beat, I don't quite remember all of it, but like, I was definitely responding mostly to the Rear Window.
Yeah, I mean, the Rear Window thing has to do more with the voyeur and looking out of the binoculars, yeah, and stuff like that, and like kind of peering into your neighbors, like the places you shouldn't be looking and seeing, yeah, private things that you shouldn't be seeing. But like the chase scene and the voyeurism of like going in the Beverly Center where they're like kind of going through the, okay, mall, yeah, and the car, and you know, all of that stuff is very, very Vertigo. The scene with the kiss that happens where the camera spins around again, we got that like great Blowout scene that you loved, you know, with Travolta. It's, he does, so it good again here, yeah, but it's a complete ripoff of Alfred Hitchcock and Vertigo, where that, okay, scene happens and he's picturing it's the other woman, you know, in the transformation. So yeah, there's a lot of maybe both, maybe it's a, like a perfect mix of both Rear Window and Vertigo.
Yeah, I guess I just respond a little bit more, or I'm just more familiar with his voyeurism obsession. And like we were talking about, because obviously Blowout is a huge part of that. And I mentioned Peeping Tom. I sent you that info that's on Criterion, which might be a good one to check out.
Oh, right.
So the other thing you were talking about, I think Craig Wasson is fucking great in this movie. I do think he's I almost want to give him the benefit of the doubt. A lot of his acting is a little cheesy and hammy, but whether or not that's intentional, I think it fucking works.
Yeah, like, so that's perfect. What I can't really understand and as like a viewer. Like, should I like that or not? I don't know.
I don't really care whether it's intentional or not, because it's just fucking, it makes what I watched today great. It just worked for the movie. And it definitely works for his character, because it's like the character is an actor who is, you know, may or may not be a great actor in the movie itself, like the character he's playing. And he ends up doing porno. So it just kind of, it works for me, like watching his character, Jake, be like an okay actor. Like he's like the entire time he's like tailing Gloria, which is the woman he's been watching.
Yeah, Gloria Ravel, I think is her name,
yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. The entire time he's like, this guy is not that great at making it seem like he's not tailing her. Like he was like so obviously such a fucking creep, just like creeping on her. I'm like, you could probably be a little bit more smooth and make it a little bit less obvious. And so it's just his, you know, questionable acting talent is certainly wasn't a problem for me. I did, because it just worked so well in it. So
yeah, I feel like that's the other thing I'm not sure about, because it's like 1984, right? So like in my kind of like, I don't know, the time period makes it feel a little bit like there's not like a lot of there's not a lot to say about like the time period other than like, you know, the lack of maybe technology to do certain things or whatever. Like the movie relies a lot on like De Palma using the camera, just like it does in Blowout, in the way that the director is like very, very secure and understands how to move that camera, you know, around. And it's also like playing with the audience a lot. I really feel like LA was an interesting place. So I sent you on Instagram that tale of the pup, and you're probably
okay. Like, yeah. So I had not watched. I watched the movie today, so I didn't know. I was like, is he doing like, what does he send me Tale of the Pup for? Is he doing their artwork for him on the new menu or something?
I know. I figured you had no idea when I said that. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, it's fine. So, I was like, I'm definitely familiar with that place with the freaky looking hot dog that it's built into.
Yeah. Well, I just loved it because like, as I was rewatching it, I have recently relocated to Los Angeles 2 years ago. So I haven't watched the film since I relocated, and I didn't realize how many places are like just right around the corner. Taylor Pup is just recently like renovated and back. And then the farmer's market makes an appearance in there, which is pretty classic. And then, you know, that home that he's in, and I remember telling my girlfriend about that, that's out here. I've never been to it, but it's obviously like such a crazy location, right? It looks like a spaceship and all that. There's a lot of information about that on the Wikipedia that you can look up, but that's here in California as well.
So I kind of did a quick look. So what I know it from is Troy McClure's house in The Simpsons.
That's true. That's right.
It's I don't know anything like actual of what it's based on, but that's what I recognized her from, is that that's the house that he's living in. In the episode when he's trying to make a comeback with Jeff Goldblum as his agent.
That's
so
right.
Like, I saw it, I was like, that 100% that's where they got this from, or at least inspired by it. So I love,
and that's what I'm trying to say about this film, like about being in the 80s, because like it's very much like, you know, a time and place in history. And so I'm not sure, like, I don't know, like I don't know why it is this like this with me, but like there's certain time periods of like movies that are made that kind of feel like maybe a little bit more cheap or something to me. Like I've talked about the 70s films kind of weird me out. There's something about the filmmaking process in these like decades that just don't feel as put together sometimes. And that's why I'm saying I think De Palma does a great job of like moving the camera around and directing this film to make it seem like that cheapness kind of like lends itself to the story. Maybe that's what I was trying to say.
Well, I mean, yeah, 84 is still the beginning of the idea of a blockbuster. And then just generally movies were still thriving in the lower budget, almost independent kind of vibe. They weren't quite indies, like they became in the 90s, but throughout the 70s, like studios were more willing to like throw, you know, a little bit of money at a movie and then give the director full control, which is what made the 70s so unique and so innovative and so important of a decade. And so going into the 80s, I mean, technology wise, I mean, I was thinking about 84 is a fucking great movie. You got the Terminator and you got Razorback in the same year.
Look at the technology difference now, in those two films, you know,
body double. Exactly. So you see like when you look back, the Terminator had some pretty innovative effects, but they were still janky. I mean, that was like a look. It was still technically, I mean, for as many special effects as it had, it was kind of a lower budget film. Like he was doing a lot of guerrilla filmmaking stuff, like filming without permits and whatnot. So that's what kind of just makes that movie so unique.
James Cameron coming off of Rock and Roll High School to make the Terminator. I mean, I didn't even know that.
I figured you'd appreciate it. Yeah, I know. I learned that a couple years ago. I was like, well, and maybe he was the one who brought in the pizzas for Dee Dee for that scene. So it's like obviously an early job for James Cameron just to help out.
But I mean, not too far removed from making Terminator. So that's got to be like the end of the 70s, maybe at Rock and Roll High School. And then he did Terminator 84, huh? So yeah, not that far removed from his job on working with the Ramones. And Roger,
you know what? Yeah, and actually, I'm seeing the connection now, and I'm thinking about it because he made so Piranha 2. I love these tangents, by the way. I'm pro tangent when we go on certain directors, just FYI. His first movie was Piranha 2, which was a sequel to Joe Dante's movie Piranha. And Joe Dante was either the co-director or co-writer of Rock and Roll High School. So there's obviously a James Cameron, Joe Dante early connection to get him started when he first started doing it. So,
yeah, wow, interesting. Yeah, I love the tangent, by the way, too. I mean, it's all these movies, and like especially like after just reading and finishing Cinema Speculation, you see how all of these things kind of meld together. And to follow what you were saying about the director having kind of like full control in the 70s, this is maybe this movie that we're talking about today is maybe on the edge of like where that kind of stopped being so much of the case, because it seems like Body Double, I read that, but De Palma, he forced the issue of a lot that he wanted to do in this film so much to where they cut ties amicably, from what I understand, with Columbia, a three-picture deal that they were supposed to be going into because of this movie bombed so bad and because they both didn't enjoy themselves. I guess he had like some comments that I read about it being owned by Pepsi, I think, or something like, or Coca-Cola or something like that. And he's like, yeah, do you think like these people like really want like the softcore porn, you know, being made yeah. underneath their umbrella, you know?
Right. Love it. Okay, I mean, speaking of the sex, I mean, yeah, first sex scene we see is his girlfriend, who is played by the great Barbara Crampton. And in that, like, once it's all she's in, he just walks in on her, she's having sex with somebody, and they kind of share that weird look that she kind of gives them. And you can see, I mean, she is a great actor. You know, she went on to do Reanimator, From Beyond, both Stuart Gordon movies, adaptations of H.P. Lovecraft, two of the best horror movies of the 80s by far. So, and you could definitely see she was a major part of that because she was such a great actress and fit right into horror so well.
Yeah, it seems like there was like a lot of like little like small parts for some big players that kind of came up later. Seemed like from when I was reading about the movie that De Palma didn't get like all of his wish list, you know, fulfilled for this film, but we got to talk about like Melanie Griffith has a big role in this. And she, I believe she credits this film to being a big reason why she's gone on to have like such a great career, apart from the fact that she's Tippi Hedren's daughter.
I was going to say, I mean, there's a Nepo, not just a Nepo baby, there's a Nepo family lineage. Yeah, I mean, I always forget that she's Tippi Hedren's daughter. But I mean, I definitely know that she's Dakota Johnson's mother.
Yeah.
So that lineage of nepotism just kind of, you know, all great actors. I mean,
this is a fucked up role as like a Hollywood royalty elite's daughter to be playing. I mean, she's basically pornography actress in this film. Yeah. And she's naked half the time, you know what
for
I mean?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's still a good opportunity for a lot of actresses who would want to work with a big director for sure. So,
yeah, I mean, but it's like, it's more naked than most people have been in films. I mean, you know, like sometimes you see topless scenes and stuff like this, but like, you're kind of almost seeing all of Melanie Griffith in this film. And again, that's the kind of film it is. And she, you know, had no problem doing any of it, but I'm joking when I say it's softcore porn, but it deals with pornography, which is like part of it. And it also shows a lot of that. It's really pushing the envelope of like what, I guess, like this didn't get an X rating, but like pop probably should have back then, you know. I believe it got an R rating.
I saw a quick interview from 84 with De Palma, pretty chill interview. And the journalist was asking like whether this was going to get an X rating. And he was just kind of laughing it off, but yeah, still like he looked straight at the camera. He was like, yes, this is an R movie. Basically, he was basically assuring the audience that yeah, you can go see this movie. This is not a porno, even though it has porn qualities to it. So
totally. I mean, especially that
you could tell he was worried about people being scared off by the X rating. So
the entire end credits, and this is a spoiler for anybody, but maybe this is why people might watch the film. The entire end of the movie is the credits are rolling over a vampire putting his hands all over a woman's breasts. I mean, that's the credits roll over that. So, you know, I think this is like one of those films as a kid that I probably would have seen on Cinemax, like scrambled out and been like, oh, what is this? You know, like excited, like, oh, there might be some naked woman on TV. Like this could have been the film.
Vampires, blood and tits. I mean, what more do you want?
Yeah. It sounds like the perfect combo, doesn't it? But yeah, I mean, the lead character is down on his luck by a lot of, you know, bad things that happen pretty quickly in this film. And his entrance into like this world happens, of course, very much like a Hitchcock movies does, because he's, you know, meets somebody just like strangers on the train or whatever, who's like, okay, I'm going to manipulate you into doing what I want done, because they see the vulnerability in somebody who needs something, right? And he needs a place to stay. He's sleeping on people's couches. And we don't really understand quite yet what's happening, but I forget the name of the character who was just like that really shitty guy who brings them to the place.
The main guy, Sam?
Yeah. What's his name? Sam?
The character is Sam, yeah.
Yeah. He really takes advantage of him, acts like he's his best friend. And here we are, we're like, okay, you know, Jake's got a great thing going. He's got this cool pad. He's finally, his luck is turning around, and he watches across the way, this girl getting undressed, and sees that she's a rich woman who, you know, has a lot of jewels and stuff. And at one point sees an Indian guy working on like, what seems like, I don't know, what is that? Like a satellite or something, and he's watching the Indian guy watching the woman, and it looks like this is where I mean, and what a great face on this guy, right? Like he's really scary looking. He's got these weird teeth and stuff like that. And this is where it really becomes like kind of like a horror movie, you know? It's like you see this character who's like frightening and ends up breaking in at one point, right? So I don't know if you want to continue on here.
I mean, yeah, like we said, this is heavy spoilers. So, I mean, were you actually, I mean, like I said, I saw this for the first time today. So were you ever like actually surprised by Sam being the guy?
Yeah.
You were.
I kind of was. Yeah. I mean, did you know the whole time?
I thought it was way obvious. And I'm not ever able to predict ending of plots or anything.
Yeah, neither am I usually. And I don't look at you.
And it's largely, I'm not. I'm usually bad at it, even if I'm trying, which I'm not. Like, I just don't watch movies. That's why, like, thrillers don't always do it for me. Like, David Fincher is one of the best directors out there, but, like, a lot of his, you know, it's not because of, like, the plot and the whodunit. It just isn't. And I don't really, I've read mystery novels before, and they're fine. I think something like Rian Johnson, again, like doing The Knives Out, great director, I'm never going to watch the Knives Out movies again because this is like...
Yeah, I'm not like a huge fan of those either. And I do love Rian Johnson. Like, I love Brick.
Yeah.
And that's another mystery, you know.
Again, it's just like you have like amazing directors making a mystery. It's definitely worth watching it. But like... figuring out a plot is just doesn't, it's just not how my brain works.
I'm surprised you knew though. I mean, he's definitely, so
I'm not giving myself any credit. I think it's entirely because we've just been talking about De Palma a lot. I've seen a lot of De Palma. I've seen a lot of Hitchcock. I know his style. I think again, because it being in the early 80s, it being so influential to so many movies that I've loved since. I mean, I thought of like Under the Silver Lake a lot while watching this movie. It's just like, this was like, innovative in a way to a lot of movies that I've seen before. So the second that the husband showed up, where you see him beaten Gloria, and then the Indian character, which is pretty wild. It was pretty obvious to me that that was Sam, the guy who gave him the apartment at the very beginning.
Yeah, it's a pretty elaborate hoax, right? You know, so yeah. For everybody watching out there, the reason I said there's spoiler alerts is because the Indian who I talked about earlier, who's watching her, the first like thing that we see, like, yeah, there's some sort of husband of the woman that Jake is watching from around the way, and he notices the first day that he's like kind of throwing her around and beating her and stuff like that. This is actually the guy Sam who introduced Jake to this home to watch in the first place. And then we see the second day, as Jake's watching the girl do her dance, he sees this Indian putting together like some sort of, I don't know, maintenance on a satellite, and who's peering in to watch the show that second night. But that all of these people are the same people. So the husband, the Indian, and the guy that is Sam, who's the friend Scully has that put him into his place. It's like really a lot going on here, but it's the same character, but we don't know that yet as the audience. We just think there's this like interesting thing unfolding, except for Pat, who figured it out right away, I guess.
Again, it's like,
no
credit to myself. I know his obsession with doubles, and it was mostly the framing, just like the covering. And it was partly, so like the actor we're talking about is Greg Henry. You can kind of, I mean, it's pretty obvious in terms of his body frame that and build that like he's introduced as Sam. And then each time they cut to either the husband or the other character, it's like, it's, and you can kind of see it in his eyes. I mean, the second I was like suspecting it, I was like, yeah, that's obviously the same actor doing it.
So I guess the thing that like you might not, did you know that Melanie Griffith was like the body double for the wife doing the dance or anything like that?
I mean, I think it was, I mean, a lot of those shots were clearly not Melanie Griffith because you could see, right?
Right. But then okay. You like later on, you find out that it was her in like playing that role to trick him. The reason,
which I was still kind of confused.
Yeah, because the reason this unfolds is he sees that porno that he's watching, right, and Melanie Griffiths is doing the dance in that.
Yeah.
I've seen that before. Yeah, so like that plot line is 100% Vertigo as well, because like the body double of replacing the wife with somebody else, pretending to be the wife so that you know can dispose of the real wife and kill her or whatever like that. Like that's the whole point. Man, but yeah, it's a little confusing. Yeah, there's a lot going on here. Yeah.
No, I mean, I don't think this plot, the plot was, or the story wasn't confusing at all, really. It was just more of his directing style, I guess, is just what I loved about it too. But then also like partly why it was obviously Greg Henry, the actor. But then I guess, the only thing like, so when he was originally watching Gloria, that was Gloria. Or
yeah, so they're saying basically that it wasn't.
They're saying it wasn't, but with the way De Palma shot those original scenes, it wasn't Melanie Griffith, it was the other actress.
That's what I think.
Okay,
but
gotcha.
They're saying basically at the end, like, no, that was Melanie Griffith, because she admits it. She's like, yeah, I was paid to go over there and do this dance or whatever.
So I'm definitely cool with that, like, because you can tell it's not a Melanie Griffith dancing at the beginning, because you could see the woman's face. And I know what Melanie Griffith looked like. I could tell that wasn't her. But then just for them to be like, well, this is, you know, what is real, you know, it, just because something's on, you have a shot of it doesn't mean it's real or it's not somebody else's perception of it. So,
yeah. And then there's that scene that he's like basically obsessed with the woman, whoever that is, that he's peering into. He kind of doesn't even really care who it is because of that kiss scene that happens. It's like, oh, well, now I'm with Melanie Griffith, but I'm thinking that it's that woman that I was seeing in there. So yeah, you're playing with like the reality that all of us are experiencing, the characters and the person that's living this life, the actor, the struggling actor, Jake Scully, who's our main character.
Yeah. Greg Hengrini, speaking of him, Sam, I mean, I knew him from, and he's been in a lot. He's been in a couple of the Bourne movies. I knew him from the James Gunn horror movie Slither. I don't know if you ever saw that. He plays the mayor in the small town. He's second or third lead in that movie, and he's fucking hilarious in that movie. He's so good, and I could like see, like, he's got glimpses of that smarmy asshole type early in this movie, and I was like, yeah, I could see why James Gunn wanted him for that role. So
yeah, James Gunn went on to have a pretty good career after that, huh?
He showed up in Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm just looking at his name. He played MacReady in Slither, by the way.
Oh, really? Okay.
Clear John Carpenter reference for the thing on that one.
Yeah.
Which is not the only reference, actually, in Slither. What a great movie.
2006 is Slither, I think, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Really good. He was great. It was also partly, like I said, it's like I knew this actor was like a second or third lead. And by the time he disappeared, I'm like, well, he's obviously one of these actors if he's like a second or third lead, because you haven't seen Sam for like an hour. So he's obviously somebody who's on screen the whole time. So
totally. And I just love that scene. I mean, there's a lot of like cool little talk about like nice, like little voyeuristic moments. And there's that really nice, again, very much an homage to Hitchcock, where he's following the actor. I'm sorry, not the actor. The character, Jake Scully, is following the woman who he sees dancing in the window across the way. And what's her name again? It's Rachel, right? Sorry, I'm getting mixed up on this.
Gloria is the original girl.
Oh, Gloria. So it's actually Gloria. And he's following her. And they get into the Beverly Center here in LA, and then they have this whole like kind of zigzag cat and mouse game that he's having. And who so shows good. Up?
Yeah.
The Indian guy. And he's like, oh my God, she's in so much danger. But he's like sitting there as a peeping Tom, like watching her put her underwear on. And then on the other end of the glass is the Indian. And that's such a great, well done sequence. I mean, that's De Palma at like peak De Palma for sure right there.
Oh, I mean, some of the tracking shots. It's also just like a pacing that just doesn't really happen in movies anymore. Somebody was mentioning like at the time, I'm thinking of like Alien, the original Alien. Like that movie was seen as like overly fast paced and just too much in your face at the time. And it's like, now it's like, there's no way a movie would be ever that slow of a pace now, just on like a big scale like that at all. It seemed like a drudgery to a lot of mainstream audiences now. It just shows like how like the directors got to take their time a little bit more back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing about it. It's like, it's taking you on a ride and you kind of have to like sign up for that, you know. That Beverly Center stuff is great too, because there's a lot of high shots, so you can kind of see like, again, the kind of cat and mouse, the kind of mousetrap idea that's happening here, where, you know, getting on escalators, getting in elevators, following dead ends, you know, that kind of stuff. Really cool. Then we got that great scene that comes up when he leaves the Beverly Center and he follows Gloria to this place that's in Long Beach, and it's basically overlooking the ocean. And then, you know, when you see those like great like kind of Jaws-esque like little like huts on the beach, you know those are going to play like somehow in like a maze as well. And that's when you know, the Indian finally reveals himself to and snatches that purse. That's such a great scene, and especially it's actually very much terrifying. I don't know if you felt this way when they do get into that tunnel, and Jake, our lead actor here, kind of has that I can't go any further because he has that vertigo thing that happens to him, and this trauma impacts him where he can't really move. He's in this closed space, claustrophobia, I guess is what you'd call it. And the Indian realizes like this guy is in trouble and he can't do anything. And he takes advantage and takes his time to go through the, and we get to watch the Indian go through the wallet and take what he wants with the lead character through the lead character. We're also paralyzed, like we can't move, but, and we, yet we have to watch this horror unfold of the Indians taking, and like, what else is he going to do? Is he going to come and kill him? You know, like you just don't know what's going to happen. And he does that quick, woo, and he like runs away, and it's like, oh my god, this is like fucking scary, you know. I don't know if you felt that way. You
guys having fun with it for sure. Yeah, that's why I think Watson is good in this movie, because there's scenes where he's having like panic attacks basically because of the claustrophobia. I mean, those are pretty legit on screen at least. So,
but you know what's kind of like the thing that this is where I'm saying it's like a little things I could have done better a little bit, you know. He comes out of the, gets help. Gloria finally comes over, sees that he got the, you know, purse back, but like that he's in trouble, that he's, he, you know, and he asks for help. Can you get me, help me get out of here? Gloria and him are like finally like talking, you know, she noticed that he's following him or her. But when they get out of there, all of a sudden they share this kiss. Again, very vertigo and everything's spinning. And it's kind of like, I just don't really believe it. Like, you know, like they don't know each other at all. There really doesn't seem to be very much chemistry between the two of them. I guess maybe it's just like the excitement of the fact that like there's this like person following me. And, you know, obviously he's obsessed with her.
I mean, I mean, I get what you're saying. I mean, but it definitely works. I mean, nothing in this movie is believable. So it's like the fact that they just pull out of the tunnel and just start making out. Definitely, I think,
and kind of like weirdly making out. You know, like why I'm saying, like, I don't know, Jake Scully is kind of like a weird guy. Like he doesn't.
He's like, oh, you've been following me, haven't you? No, and then they just start making out. It's like, what? Yeah. I mean. There's nothing about that dialogue that makes sense. So I wouldn't expect anything about like the progression to them having sex or anything.
To you makes more sense to me about that scene, because again, that scene has to happen for the movie to have like any kind of like, you have to have the understanding that that happened for the rest of the movie to kind of culminate. But like, I guess it doesn't matter. Yeah. Like you don't have to really believe it, but it has to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it really is just, again, it's just how you're watching certain movies. It's like, it's what you see on screen, you know, doesn't have to represent reality. If you're on board for like most of what you're seeing is not reality, then, you know, that doesn't mean you can just get away with anything, but like, you can have a character arc where voyeurism leads to porn and it works perfectly.
Well, that's the difference. Okay. So you have this film where you get this, and again, you don't really have to believe it, or, you know, you're getting into a movie like this for a certain style, and you don't have to fully be engaged. Or you could get into like, you know, Shutter Island, where like you kind of have a lot of things that are happening in this movie happening in Shutter Island. Yet the connection between the lead character and the wife that he's lost, that brought him to the brink of where he's now in this insane asylum. You believe those scenes when it's Michelle Williams and Leonardo DiCaprio, and you are really connected to their story, and you're really, really invested in the two of them and how they got to where they are. But that's not happening in this film. Like these two people could like make out like they do, or they could not. Like you don't feel anything.
Yeah. I need to rewatch Shutter Island, by the way. I haven't seen it since the theaters.
It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I've seen like kind of a few small clips ever since. I mean, I remember loving it for sure. And it being one of the more plot heavy movies for Scorsese.
I mean, it's a lot like this because, like, it's kind of like there's a lot of twists and turns, and there's a lot of, like, we don't, the audience doesn't really know what's going on the whole time. So, but,
and there's no reason why, like, based on the ending, like, I should have, like, just rewatched it immediately, but I didn't, and I haven't gotten around to it since. So,
yeah, maybe that's a little bit of an overlooked Scorsese, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, again, he's like Bob Dylan, because his everything he does is pretty great. So, like, even like the stuff that doesn't, like, rise to the complete top gets overlooked, even though that's still better than what most other people are putting out. So
2010. So that movie's like 13 years old now. I think it's 2010.
Was it really? Oh
yeah.
My God. Holy shit.
Mark Ruffalo is awesome in that as well.
Yeah. We got October for Killers of the Flower Moon. I think I originally said April, which may have been the Cannes premiere, but I don't think we'll be able to see it unless we go to Cannes until October. So
I didn't know that that was a final, that had been announced that they were going to do that in October. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, that's, I'm pretty sure that's the official release date. And well, I sent you.
Here's hoping I live to October to see it.
I sent you. Oh, okay. So we'll keep it with De Palma, but a couple of actors. That is possible that Brendan Fraser, his character is getting cut, but then also I learned from the same article that John Lithgow filmed some scenes in Killers of the Flower Moon, and then apparently maybe his scenes got cut. Although the runtime is pushing 4 hours, so I don't know who's getting cut.
Shut the fuck up.
That's the last number that I saw. So I don't know who's getting.
What's cut. What's going on with this film?
I mean, right.
You know, it's getting done for a while. It seems like, but it, yeah.
Killers? No.
I mean, it's been shot. It's been, I think that it's been in the can. I think it's like more in the edit now, isn't it?
Now, but it's not like it's been like, it's not like it was shot like 3 years ago.
Because then I also heard that they had to go back and like shoot some like pretty key scenes that when they thought they were finished. I don't know. It's maybe. Weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge Scorsese movie, so it's obviously a long shoot, but I don't know. I really hope both Fraser and John Lithgow end up in the movie. And staying on Lithgow for a second, we had an awesome discussion talking about him last week. But yeah, shout out to our friend of the show, Don. He pointed out, he was putting a spotlight on Lithgow's performance in The Twilight Zone. I think he commented on YouTube on that. Have you seen Twilight Zone, the movie?
I saw his comment. I haven't seen that. Like the gremlin thing?
Okay, so Twilight Zone, the movie, I grew up watching. It was on HBO all the time. So I remember seeing it a lot when I was like a young kid. I probably saw that even before some of the old episodes. It's a four-part movie, four different directors. Spielberg does one of the scenes. Joe Dante, who we were just talking about, did Gremlins. He did one of the scenes. John Landis, which I think he did the scene where the actor was actually killed in a helicopter crash. It was like it was a pretty notorious thing. It was like they were filming on site and there was a helicopter crash. The actor who's actually the asshole coach from Bad News Bears, that actor was killed along with a couple other people. Landis did that one. But then, so the fourth one is the John Lithgow one. It's the one 20,000 feet, Nightmare at 20,000 feet. It was like the original one with William Shatner on the plane when he sees the gremlin out in the window.
Yeah.
So it's a remake of that. So this scene is directed by George Miller of Mad Max fame, did all four of the Mad Max movies. And I found out that George Miller did this one like around the time Fury Road came out, which is still one of my favorite movies of that decade. And it just blew my mind because you can see George Miller's style, which is like fucking intense and like in your face, like most of the time throughout the entire skit. And John Lithgow is so good at just like, he keeps on seeing this gremlin out on the side of the plane, keeps on trying to tell everybody on the plane, nobody believes him. And he's just getting increasingly like, he's going insane basically, because he's like, he already has a fear of flying. And then now you're seeing this, this monster out on the side of the plane, trying to destroy the plane. Fucking great. I would highly recommend checking out at the very least that scene, if not the whole movie. But yeah, just adding That's definitely an awesome performance by John Lithgow.
It's all, everything you're talking about, even like the helicopter crash, all of these like stories are very familiar to me. And I don't know why, like maybe I saw it one point in my life, but like, cause like, even like the whole like John Lithgow and a gremlin, like it sounds familiar. I just don't know where I would have seen it.
I mean, it was on TV a lot when we were growing up. I mean, I think it was 83, I want to say.
I mean, those directors are all pretty big heavy hitters, you know?
It's all. I mean, George Miller was obviously the among directors as famous, just not as famous of a name. It was definitely seen as like kind of a debacle with the helicopter crash, but it definitely is a bananas movie, as a Twilight movie should be, so...
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Did you just pause for a second? This is definitely something I got to check out. And so, dude, kudos to Don for knowing that and writing that, because Lithgow is like, I think underappreciated. I mean, I think we can honestly say that and that be true. Like, I know like people know who he is and he's Third Rock from the Sun and shit like that. But like some of the movies we're talking about, like even Blowout last time, he's insanely good in that.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I would not be against keeping with De Palma maybe for a few more movies and maybe even doing Raising Kane. That would be more of a fun Lithgow movie to watch, even though it was directed by De Palma. It's got a lot of tinges of it, but like it's a pretty unhinged performance, and it's been a few years since I've seen it, but like it's definitely a fun one to watch. So
I think we were talking last time, like he's written a few books too. I bet you those are pretty entertaining.
A couple of kids books. I read his memoir, which was pretty decent. So
Of course you did. I feel like anyone who needs a book recommendation, you need to ask Pat. I mean, you need to like really seriously hit him up. He's got some great picks.
I have great picks for myself. I know what I like, you know, which is sometimes what other people like. So
that was what I liked it.
The one I said, I've been reading Animal Horror Cinema, which is academic collection of basically creature features throughout the years. Some great fucking hits on there. And I saw that at Bucket of Blood here in Chicago, which is one of the best record stores in Chicago. And it was definitely a just impromptu find, because that book was not on my radar. Barely even would have expected that there's an academic dissertation on animal horror cinema in America. And so it's like, this is definitely it's so good. A couple movies in there. I mean, one that I mentioned before I would love to cover is Alligator, the John Sayles movie with Robert Forster, which is one I grew up loving.
Talked about a lot of cinema speculation as well.
That's right. It's such a great movie. I mean,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I think a lot of those, we talked about Piranha earlier, just like a lot of those, like, you know, a lot of people trying to remake Jaws just in different ways back then, you know?
Right. I mean, it started with King Kong being the original animal horror creature feature. It's such like, I mean, it's such a good vehicle for an entertaining movie in terms of like, you have this thing that represents anything, you know, you can have Kong as Christ, Kong as racism, Kong as whatever. And then, so you can dig into that, but at the same time, you have just like this monster movie that you can sell to audiences. So it just is
like made the monster represents to kind of doesn't matter. It could be anything.
It could be anything. It could be something very heady. It could be nothing, but it's just always been one of my favorite.
Are you a fan of the like Godzilla movies then?
Oh yeah. I love Vigan. Huge. Yeah. I mean, creature features, that's my favorite subgenre for sure. Horror and drama are my favorite high level genres, but like within horror,
the monster. That's why Mosquito is right up your alley.
Oh yeah, dude. Again, you blew my mind. I was watching a few more scenes after we talked about it. You blew my mind with that casting, because that was one that I remember watching as a kid, but then having no idea who the deep talent that was in that movie. So,
well, totally. Again, just like watching Body Double here, you know, like there's a lot of things that you kind of like, you get to see the set of LA, like all these things. Okay. So I'm sorry. Here we are tangent at the end of this talk, but I'll just say I'm literally on season 5 of, you know what I'm going to say, like we're right about, I don't want to say what's going to happen, but we're right about at like the really big turning point in Six Feet Under, like probably going to watch that tonight. And I'm like,
hell yeah,
preparing myself for it. But yet my girlfriend like has no idea what's coming. I've told her to stay away from every single fucking spoiler that she could like ever possibly be aware of. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing up Six Feet Under again is because, again, they're like here. They're in L.A. So I'm like getting an experience of show. It's like my third watch through. And I'm getting to like see these places that like they just seem like a dream to you, you know, unless you live here and you're like experiencing them every day. Now they're like familiar, right? And so that's kind of like what Body Double was like in watching it this time, is that I get to see like the farmer's market that I've been to a million times, you know, like but like it just felt like so like mysterious LA or mysterious locations at the time. And you like, oh yeah, like not everybody lives in Los Angeles, like they're like, you know, but if you do, then it's kind of like this like insider's like, oh yeah, that's like the farmer's market, you know, or like blah, 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 that's tail of the pup or whatever, you know.
Totally. I mean, most people don't live in LA, so you definitely got the little insights that are just making everything better.
Well, that's what I love about our podcast, is like you've got the Chicago connection now, and I've got the LA connection. You know, I feel like those are like the two greatest places you could ever live, like, you know, I guess in my opinion. So like, you know, we've got insight into that. I love when you talk about like going to the Music Box. Like I love going to Los Feliz 3, but they're not playing Renfield this weekend. So my girlfriend and I tomorrow are going to go and see Renfield if we can, at like any place that is playing it close by. Got to see Renfield.
I'm going to rewatch Weatherman. That's the one I was mentioning. Gore Verbinski of Pirates of the Caribbean. Awesome. Oh, right. Director. Lone Ranger. Weatherman is his low-key drama that he made, I think, 2006. Fucking awesome Nicolas Cage movie. And Nicholas Holt, who's a great kid actor, who's grown up to be an awesome adult actor.
Shit, so they're in that together.
He plays, Nicholas Holt plays Cage's son in that movie.
Amazing.
And he's not, you know, he's a major character. He's not like the, Michael Caine is his father also. So it's kind of an ensemble, but Nicholas Holt has a lot of pretty important scenes actually in that movie, and it's fucking great. I love it. I should rewatch that before I go see Renfield. Yeah, you excited? I know you've been looking forward to it for quite a bit. You've been sending me every single
you don't know like what's on my phone or what I haven't sent you. So like for the audience out there listening, like I've been sending, there's so because it's a universal picture. I think this is pretty big for Cage. This is like something more like high level than he's been in a while. Like he's been in a lot more indie films than like he has big studio shit, but this is Universal's baby. This is Dracula, you know? Right. So like they're definitely really, really pushing it out here. And yeah, it's on bus, like on the side of a bus. They got billboards everywhere. And it's not just in Los Feliz, which is where I live. It's also in like Pasadena, which is, you know, if I'm over in Pasadena, like everywhere. And like, dude, I'm telling you, I've taken pictures and I'm like, I can't send them another one of these. Like, there's probably like another.
No filter. You send me all the fucking movie posters, especially if it's Cage related.
So. Yeah. There's definitely like another five billboards that I haven't sent you. Like, it's everywhere you look out here right now. So expect good things for like, you know, the box office for it, I hope. I'm a little worried when I see like comedy and Dracula together. That's my only hang up. I'll just say that right now, because I just like want to get into like the character of Dracula a little bit more serious than comedic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so Dracula Dead and Loving It by Mel Brooks is right up your alley, right?
Yeah, by Leslie Nielsen, right?
Oh man, I rewatched Naked Gun last year. Leslie Nielsen was like a fucking god, like among comedy, like what, just generally what he was like. I didn't realize how far back he went, like just being a leading man starting in the 50s. And then just how like crazy it was that he was a leading man for like a couple decades. Not like crazy successful as like a leading man actor, but like that's the roles he was taking, like as a dramatic actor. And then they just started putting him in comedies. Like he still acted the same. They just made everything around him just fucking like spoof and satire.
Kind of like Robert Stack was in like a lot of those like old, like basic, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they were both in Airplane.
Yeah. And then, or he's now he's like the host of like Unsolved Mysteries, and that's like all you know him as, you know. It's interesting, like the way like an actor's career can go based on the choices you make. I have a quick Leslie Nielsen story that I have to tell because I'm not sure if anybody's going to hear this one. I don't know if the Plain White Tees will ever tell this story, but so like when the Plain White Tees were starting to like really have like success and like, you know, we're all like so excited about it. All their friends and everybody, the family, we're watching them on TV. It's like right at the beginning of their success, and WGN is having them on as the musical guests. And so I don't think Delilah had like hit yet, but like they were just like, you know, on their way, like they had been signed to a major label and all that kind of stuff. Hometown Heroes playing WGN, if anybody in Chicago knows, but anybody else, WGN's kind of like the news station that we watched. Like they'd have the Cubs games aired on it and everything. And so that morning, like I remember Tirio telling me, Dave Tirio, who's a guitar player, he's playing my tees, is like, yeah, Leslie Nielsen's going to be on with us.
Oh,
yeah. So geez. It's like playing my tees musical guest. And then, you know, it's a morning show with Leslie Nielsen. And they go to like, this is such a great story. They go to like meet him, and Dave like is like, hey, Leslie Nielsen, nice to meet you. And he's like, great to meet you guys too. And it's like a fart, and like stone face, stone cold, doesn't move or twitch. And like, but this fart just happened, you know? And so Dave shakes his hand or whatever. The guy had a fucking whoopee cushion on him and put it underneath his chair and didn't ever acknowledge that that happened. Just like acted as if he farted.
This was his thing. There are compilations. He did that all over the place. He did that to Conan. He did that to Leno. He did that to every talk show he did or interview for like the last 15 years of his life, he was bringing the fucking whoopee cushion machine or what, an actual whoopee cushion. And there are compilations on YouTube. You can see him just doing it to everybody.
Oh man.
What a fucking legend. This is like so ridiculous. He's just, and he's talked about it. Like there are a couple interviews. It was like, what's your secret to life? He's just like not taking yourself too seriously. It's like just was his philosophy in life. And like, cause like what fucking actor is going to be doing that for decades as they're like, as they're making all these comedy movies, and you think that maybe he takes himself too seriously. Nope. He's just pulling childish pranks on everybody.
I mean, here we are trying to keep entertaining talking himself. About it. Yeah. Oh,
he was so good, man. Great. That is man. Okay. So that's, Terrio is definitely in a, league of legends who got, pranked.
I know, like you got Leslie to experience Nielsen. The whoopee cushion, right? Oh. Yeah. I'm sure they could tell the story better, but that's what I remember from it. And, a lot of times, like I'll be in like a text thread, Dave and I, and Matt Allison, who I've talked about on the podcast before, who's our engineer, we're on a thread for like a text thread for the Cubs. And we're always talking about like baseball, but every once in a while, we'll bring up the Leslie Nielsen story because it's too good not to like constantly bring up, you know?
Oh, awesome.
So why don't we finish up Body Double here so that we can talk about a few other things, especially our music picks of the week. And I know you said you had some Criterion news you wanted to talk about. I'll just say this about Body Double. Not as good as Blowout. If you are watching these back to back, I think you'll enjoy them. And I think that they pair nicely together. I just think that this one is a little bit, you're like moving too much into like De Palma, like you said, having a Alfred Hitchcock wank fest here. I mean, you could go watch
Vertigo. I meant that as a compliment. But
I know. And I think that's the thing is like, you know, at this point, Hitchcock was gone already 4 years. He had passed away. So there was like a resurgence. And I wonder I don't know what it's like to live in 84 because I was only 4 years old back then. But, you know, what was the time like? Did people love Vertigo back then like they do now? I mean, I know it took a long time for people to like really think of Vertigo as like, in fact, I think Roger Ebert had a lot to do with that because a lot of times it was like, yo, number one best movie of all time is Citizen Kane. And I think like the challenge came from Ebert, who was like, no, it's Vertigo, you know? I don't know if it was quite yet looked at, if Vertigo was quite yet looked at as like the movie that it is now. Rear Window, I think, was like pretty big hit like through and through, So it's kind of interesting, like De Palma was just like a big fan of Hitchcock, like from, you know, all I know about him, and he's paying big time homage to him. But it is an original story too. I mean, it is a cool story. De Palma is a good writer, and he knows how to write a good movie. So all in all, I think it's a great film. This is the one that, like, I was told, watch Body Double and Blowout back in the day from Matt Allison, who I've talked about and just talked about. Yeah. He said both of these films are right up your alley, Darren. And he wasn't wrong, because he knew I loved Alfred Hitchcock, and both films are very much Hitchcockian, and great films on their own. De Palma, I don't know if he did too much after this film that has gotten a lot of accolade. I mean, I think he kind of has fallen off, you know, past Body Double. So this might have been like the last great film of his career. I mean, you know, I'm not exactly sure what came after this. So I can't recall. I guess Untouchables would be 89. So maybe Untouchables was the last great De Palma film.
Well, I mean, we can go through it kind of quick here. So, I mean, to kind of go back to what we were saying at the beginning, awesome three movie run. Although I do Scarface's. I mean, people love Scarface, but Scarface is okay.
I mean, Blowout, I love Scarface, but yeah, not like on the level that people do. Yeah.
Blowout is 81. He followed that up with Scarface in 83. And then just a year later, Body Double in 84. So that was where those fell in. He did a Bruce Springsteen, Dancing in the Dark, did a movie called Wise Guys, which I'm not quite familiar with. And then Untouchables in 87. Casualties of War, which I still need to see with Michael J. Fox. Penn. I've never seen it, and
I never have either. But yeah, I agree. I'd always looked good.
They played it at the Gene Siskel, where we've been a couple times, not too long ago. I missed it, and then Bonfire of the Vanities, which is a notorious, huge bomb, like in Hollywood, just like this. Sought after book, and everybody hated this fucking movie. It was the Tom Hanks playing,
like, Dan Aykroyd in that too.
Bruce Willis, if Aykroyd's in it, it's not a lead or anything. But it's based on the novel. Melanie Griffith's in that one as well, Tom Wolfe novel. It was just a huge bomb. So I feel like that's where he probably wasn't able to do everything that he wanted. Raising Kane, which again I love, Carlito's Way. And then Mission Impossible, which, you know, which I think I would love to do Mission Impossible actually next.
There's a lot of big movies in there past Body Double, but, you know, but there's like a lot of misses as well, I feel.
Yeah. I mean, but, and again, like, he didn't have, a lot of these movies are coming out. They're probably not being like sold as like Brian De Palma films. Like, nobody went to see Mission Impossible because Brian De Palma was directing a movie, you know, like, I'm sure a lot of people were like, yeah, that's awesome. But like, he was a hired director for that movie, making a franchise film. Although he did follow that up with Snake Eyes with Nicolas Cage, and I fucking love that. So I don't know. He's kind of all over the place. He's not easy to peg down.
All over the place.
He's not easy to peg down as like a definable director in Hollywood, and he never has been. So,
and then yeah, when you, I mean, when you that's factor kind of like a cool which one's way successful. To be. Like, one of those guys is like an artist that doesn't want to make the same, you know, the same thing twice, which is, you know, I like that. Definitely has a style though. I mean, you could tell it's a De Palma movie by watching. I mean, Untouchables has that force majeure stuff the whole time. I mean, Untouchables is one of the greatest films ever, in my opinion. I mean, I love it. So there's Chicago too.
There is this force majeure shot in Mission Impossible that I remember seeing it when I was a kid. I was not familiar. I saw it like right when it came out. So it was like 10 or something. And I was not familiar with De Palma and his shots, but like that shot stood out for me like by far when I saw the first Mission Impossible.
Yeah. And I mean, this film that we're talking about today, Body Double, is definitely enjoyable and definitely like something to watch. And I don't mean to say that I don't like it. I do like it. I just don't love it. It's cool. And I've seen it definitely probably like four or five times in my life. this time being a little bit different of a watch because of where I live. And I got to experience like your reaction to it too. So I'm actually very pleased that you liked it. Where would you put it on the scale of?
I think I liked it more than you probably, it sounds like, because I love it. Again, like just the ability to weave in the horror aspects and again, like I said, a plot just doesn't really attract me into a film. It's everything around it, the characters and the aesthetics. That's what I love about it. And so for a movie that's pretty plot heavy that I love, like that's even more accolades. And then
I guess that's like the reasons that you like it are actually the reasons why I don't love it as much. Like I still feel like I got to be invested with the characters and their relationship to like see a kiss like that. Like I'm not the kind of guy who can get on board with something where I don't like understand like the connection between them. I don't think there's like too much like chemistry between any of the characters, you know? Yeah, it's just like a good story being played out, you know?
Well, I mean, I watch a lot of porn. There's not always connection in that. So, and then they end up fucking. So maybe it's just my porn addled mind is a pro this maybe. Porn movie. So
yeah, true. That, and by the way, we didn't talk about it. We probably should. The Frankie Goes to Hollywood scene where he does become a porn actor and then has sex with Melanie Griffith, basically to be able to talk to her about like, were you the girl that was dancing in the window, and to try to get an understanding of what happened to this girl after she gets murdered. Because, you know, the lead character here does get murdered and like he's left just like in Vertigo, like obsessed and not knowing what to do now. He made out with her. Gloria's now dead. The Indian killed her with like a very phallic scene, by the way, with like I think
the drill. Yeah, oh my drill. God. Clearly just
you love that
dick in this. I mean, this shot is him drilling this fucking woman, literally drilling her, but like it's clear, just big dick action right there. So
totally. And by the way, like I think Gene Siskel had said like that's where De Palma lost me, like when he used this big drill to kill the lead character, you know, the lead female character. He's like, that's where De Palma lost me, and the rest of the movie sucked after that, basically. It does has becomes a second like life of the movie. Yeah. And that's where we meet Melanie Griffith then and kind of like realize, oh, she's this porn actress. Okay. Like now there's this whole scene where they have sex, and then, okay, now the Indian's after Melanie Griffith and is going to kill her. Yeah. It kind of does take a different, has a second life of its own at that point.
But then again, that's where Craig Wasson, when he comes in with his big dick energy as the slick back guy, just acting like the porn producer, it's like this other switch, and he's fucking great as that too. Yeah. When he's trying to pose as the porn producer. He fucking nails it. I love it.
Yeah, totally. But it ends up like, what did you think of the ending of the film?
Pretty funny. When Melanie Griffith pops up from the grave, I laughed out loud, actually.
Really? Okay.
It was, and it had to be kind of intentional because like it was cutting to him getting directed by the great Dennis Franz, who would be a great porn horror director. Cut to him like going back to, like to the originals, like, yeah, I'm experiencing this trauma and this anxiety from the claustrophobia, but I'm gonna get through it. And then it cuts right back to him actually in the grave, gets through it. The antagonist gets thrown off into the river, and then he stands up, and then Melanie Griffith pops up like a gopher or something. And I just laughed out loud. It's like, she's like, what are you doing? What are you, one of those necrophiliacs?
It's pretty nonsensical too. Like the fucking dog and like the antagonist, Sam, like both fall into the river like kind of perfectly, you know, like it's kind of ridiculous. That's that's the thing, is like the movie has these, like it is like a little cheesy that way. And don't know, is it like 80s cheesy, or is it just like cheesy on purpose? I don't know.
I think he is going for that horror kind of vibe, and again, that's a through line of why I loved the movie so much. So
totally makes sense to me, especially knowing you, that you would love those aspects of the film. Those are the things that kind of like, I just couldn't get on board with 100%. Blowout doesn't have so much of that, right? Blowout is like, has some cheesy stuff, but it's perfect. It's just the right amount. This is a little overdone, if you ask me.
I agree with everything you say, and I will defend cheesy until the day I die.
Yeah, I know you will.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's Brian De Palma's Blowout. Body Double. Check it out. I definitely think if you like Blowout, you will like this. It's just a different vibe. Maybe it's more fun. You know, maybe I'm no fun. Maybe I got to be more like Leslie Nielsen and carry a whoopee cushion around.
We can all learn a lot from Leslie. All right. Yeah. Awesome. Good pick, man. You're crushing it with De Palma days. So again, like I said, maybe we could talk about what to cover next, but I would definitely be down for a little bit more De Palma. I think I mentioned Mission Impossible. I would definitely
I have never seen it. I'm cool seeing Mission Impossible.
That's partly De Palma, but also partly going like more of like watching it as a Tom Cruise double feature. Because I know you're on a big Tom Cruise kick these days, but yeah.
The more and more I think about Tom Cruise, the more and more I'm fucking loving the guy. Like, yeah. And it's not about what, okay, fine. I'm over the Top Gun Maverick, but they've got to make a third one, right? I mean, it feels like the story's done, but it's like such a fucking blockbuster. I feel like they're going to like do something.
Yeah, that's hard to pin down. I mean, he took this long to make another one because he doesn't fuck around. Like he's such a fucking lunatic, and which is what makes him such a great movie star. So it's like, I would have no problem with there not being another Top Gun. But yeah, the original Mission Impossible and then the most recent Mission Impossible Fallout are, I think, the two best. And that would be a fun fucking double feature because Fallout is only a few years old. And so it has a lot of Top Gun. It just has that over the top real filmmaking obsession that Tom Cruise has been writhing in the last like 20 years. So.
Yeah, and plus with Mission Impossible, we can talk, obviously more about like De Palma. I don't think he really loved that film, from what I've heard. I need to rewatch that De Palma documentary that came out. It was excellent, but I kind of can't remember. I remember enough of him kind of hating on that film a little bit.
I mean, I'm not surprised at that at all. Again, that's a good movie because of Tom Cruise. And not necessarily, I'm like, I watch it as a Tom Cruise movie, certainly not as a Brian De Palma movie at all. So
gotcha.
Even though,
but then like, here's you the thing:
see about a lot Cruise. Of the stuff in it. So
the fucking guy in like comedy stuff, like Tropic Thunder and stuff like that. I just like thought about that the other day. Like, this guy's fucking great in that shit. I don't know. That's a whole nother story. But I'm kind of like rolling back, like. What I think about Tom Cruise and like the media and stuff like that. And I'm starting to look at him just as like more of like the actor, like again, like with my friend Tom back here, like if I can take him out of it and just look at it, the art he's making, like fucking awesome. Like, you know, Tom Cruise, if I could take like who I'm hearing Tom Cruise is about in the media, if I take all of that away and just look at him as an actor, like top tier, dude.
Yeah, you got to stop watching TMZ, dude.
I fucking love TMZ. I know I'm preaching to the choir here about Tom Cruise, but yeah, I got to stop watching so much TMZ.
It is one thing I don't quite understand. I don't know how you put that on and actually like.
Well, I don't because I don't have television. I'm just like literally that's my news source. Like I just like type in TMZ every morning. I'm like, okay, what's happening in the entertainment?
Type in TMZ every morning. That's your morning routine with your coffee?
Fuck yeah. Like that. I do not go to CNN anything like that. Like I feel like it's truthful, man. I'm telling you.
Wait a minute. It's still all celebrity news, right? That's what I know.
Pretty much. TMZ. But what else is there? What other news is there?
Oh yeah. I'm not going to defend CNN or MSNBC. Fuck that. especially not Fox News, but I guess I just find it funny that that's in your routine.
I mean, I have no other news source. I mean, I don't really go on Twitter or anything like that. It's TMZ. That's it.
I mean, Twitter's a shitty place for news as well. So, yeah. I mean, you're making a good case by just eliminating all the other ones, being like, yeah, that's garbage as well. So,
yeah.
All right. Maybe yeah, tomorrow I'll type in TMZ first.
Probably yeah, not. Let me know how your day goes then, you know?
Yeah. Love it. All right, cool. Any last closing thoughts?
No, I think this is good talk. Thanks for opening it up to doing a couple of diploma features. We'll see what we do next week. Maybe we'll keep going.
Again, like Raising Cain and Phantom of the Paradise or Mission Impossible, I would 100% be down for all of those. So, and then The other one that I was thinking about is Copland, which is a fucking great.
Oh yeah, with Leota and fucking Stallone. Yeah,
and it's James Mangold, who's
Harvey Keitel too, right?
Harvey, it's Ray Liotta, Robert De Niro, Keitel, a bunch of.
Mangold did like a lot of great movies. Walk the Line. Yeah.
Yeah. He did what I think is the best superhero movie, Logan, because it's a straight up Western.
Oh, right. I've seen that, by the way. I did like that.
His upcoming movie is actually Bob Dylan biopic.
God, no more Bob Dylan shit. Like, just all, dude.
Wait a minute.
How many biopics do we need on Bob Dylan? How many, like, fucking biographies on Bob Dylan do we need?
Well, there really, I mean, a straight up traditional one, there hasn't been any.
Yeah. Didn't Scorsese do one?
That's a documentary.
Yeah.
But then there's also that one where, like, which I'm not usually down with biopics, but like a Walk the Line style movie about Bob Dylan.
That's true. But then there was that film that came out a little while ago where it was like Heath Ledger played him, and then
yeah, I'm not there. And that's like a vignette of a bunch of different people playing him in different kind of styles, not really giving anything about his life. That was like an art film, which I fucking love. But like, again, there's never been really a traditional biopic of like his life, which I'm not saying I need, but. James Mangold is a great director, and I fucking love Bob Dylan, so I'm definitely
he did a great job with Walk. I love Walk the Line, so, you know, all right. Sign me up, fine. I'll watch it.
I mean, go ahead. What do you got? If you're watching YouTube, if you're not watching YouTube, Darren's excited for something right now, like really excited, so.
Last week, we talked about, you're right. Because last week we talked about Air.
I have a story about Air. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I fucking saw Air at the Los Feliz 3.
So I saw half of Air.
Whoa.
So you go first.
Okay. I loved it.
Look at you.
I didn't want to see it. If you go back and rewind to last week's conversation, I was like fucking Ben Affleck and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, fucking who gives a shit? Okay, I liked Argo, and I like him as a director. I just kind of, like, can't get over, like, Ben Affleck. It's kind of, like, just like, I don't know. It's, like, just something about him. I just feel like he's just kind of, like, a kind of a bum. But I do like him. That's not to say I don't like him. I just, you know, again, it's, like, he's, like, kind of, like, whenever I see him, I'm just, like, oh, Jesus, this guy. He just reminds me of, like, the guy who drinks, like, Red Bulls all fucking day and, like, you know. I don't know. So he smokes cigarettes. He's just like a weird guy. I don't know. But anyway.
You pay too much attention to these fucking actors' lives by watching TMZ.
You're right. You're right.
I go into these movies with zero baggage because I can't stand watching their personal lives.
Okay.
You're bringing in too much baggage. I'm just going to say that. So,
okay. You're right. Maybe you're right. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, especially because of the fact that, look, like, we're from Chicago. Like, we fucking love Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
And I liked a lot of it. Another kind of interesting thing about it, and it's not giving too much away, but like not really showing Michael Jordan in it, I thought was like a kind of like a Top Gun Maverick move of, you know, not showing who the enemy is or whatever. Like, everybody always knows, like, I think that was like his point. It's like everybody knows who Michael Jordan looks like. So if you show him, like,
it's. And it wasn't the story. It wasn't the story. Yeah, exactly. So that was perfect about it. So. That's awesome that you loved it. Yeah, I still have to finish the second half of it.
I went to see it with my friend Cody, who's a big fan of Michael Jordan. As you know, the lead singer of the Cutthroats. And he's like, yo, we got to go see Air today. I was like, yeah, let's go see it. So I was pleasantly surprised. I loved it. I thought you'd enjoy that. What was your experience like?
Shitty. I went to Alamo Draft House, which has been good, But as we discussed, I can't fucking stand people eating chicken wings. It was
That's your second time that's happened to you.
It was brutal. It was the only time I've left the Alamo. There were a lot of people in other screenings that I didn't leave, but like it was pretty shitty. Like, and I'm not like in, you know, I'm a very patient person. It was just like I didn't need to.
Got to be a lot to bring you over the edge like that. I feel like, yeah.
And again, it wasn't like me like protesting anything. I was just like, this is a movie that I'm going to be able to watch again. These people are being really fucking loud with their food. And so I'm just going to finish the second half at another time. Cause I was,
why do you go to this fucking theater? I mean,
it just opened. This is only like the fourth or fifth time. And it is a great theater. It's just, I'm not fully on board with the whole dining experience at a theater. I don't know. Maybe you are. Are you ordering like full meals when you're going to any movies or anything?
Not a fucking chance. And
yeah, exactly. So yeah, I'm not going to shit on people who would like to do that, but it doesn't really appeal to me. Because I so support like what Alamo does in terms of like screening and programming, the movies they play. They got like, they're playing Days of Confused tomorrow, just randomly, because they just want to show it. I just have to be a little more conscious and not go into like sold out screenings or anything. So
fair enough. Yeah. I mean, I haven't been to an Alamo Draft House. I don't mean to shit on it because I don't know the experience, but I don't like the, you know, full meals bullshit. Like when I go to films, like I rarely even get popcorn, but when I do, like I kind of eat it all and like before the movie even starts, you know. So I always get to a theater, like,
yeah,
it's like pretty serious for me to get like to a theater way before it starts. I like to get like a good seat and just kind of be there, dude. There's nothing like a cherry Coke. I was just talking to my girlfriend about this last night, getting a cherry Coke like at fucking New Beverly.
Oh yeah. There you go.
And it says tasty beverage on the cup. Like fucking experience is so great. I love it.
Yeah.
But anyway, Air, I recommend if you haven't seen the end of it, go back and see it whenever you do. I can't believe I'm saying that I saw it, but I did.
You just kind of listen to me and my recommendations a little
bit. I know.
Without bringing the TMZ baggage into it.
So, That's true.
I mean, I fucking love the Affleck brothers. Casey is a fucking amazing movie.
Yeah.
Or actor. And I definitely want to cover Manchester.
Fucking love Manchester.
I mean, it's up there with that was one of my favorite movies of that decade. and The Way Back, I think, is an underrated Affleck movie. I think I mentioned it last week. So
yeah, I think that was coming off of like his last alcoholic binge. Here I go bringing the baggage into it again. But that was like, I think, on the heels of that. So it was interesting. I think you said it was kind of meta in that way, right? It's like, you know, deals with alcoholism.
I mean, he's playing a ragged ass dude. And you're like, this is not that far from what this guy's actually going through.
Yeah.
And it's a good movie. So yeah, support the Affleck's for sure. Yeah, and again, I don't want to come off as like with this Alamo stuff, like not being like impatient or anything. It's just like that experience. I was just like, I don't need to finish this movie. I can watch it later. So I'm going to.
Yeah, I know. I get it. Yeah. Dude, if that's all you can focus on, like, and if you can't,
it is
stoic in that situation, you got to go.
It is interesting because they push the no phones so hard, which is great, but. What I'm coming to realize, it's like, oh yeah, they push that so hard because you're fucking listening to everybody else eating shit and ordering stuff the entire time. It's like, so it's like, and as a business model, it makes sense. Like I guarantee they're banking so much money from all the food and beverage. Like that's why their membership and ticket prices are not that expensive. It's because like they're making all their money on food and beverage by far.
Gotcha. Yeah.
No doubt about that. So, you know, Music Box is always going to be my home, but you know, it's a nice little backup so far for a theater that, again, both of these are, I'm like walking distance from my place. So,
oh yeah, that's great.
Happy to have it. Music Box. Maybe we'll stick on that for a second before we get to music. They're doing the Robert Zemeckis series this weekend. And Frighteners is tomorrow night, Saturday night, midnight.
You'll be there.
It's going to be a banger of a screening. I'm pretty sure I'm gonna have to go. The midnight movies have not, like, just, I don't know, maybe I'm getting old, But I'm not getting to all the midnight movies that I usually went to in my younger age. But, you know, having no kids is great. So I can just go to a midnight movie whenever
I mean, want. But you're not going to see the Frighteners is a pretty big one to be seeing at Music Box at, you know, midnight.
It's definitely a fun. Yeah, I'm just talking like, I don't know if I'm going to stay awake the whole time. That's all I'm saying.
Dude, come for Jake Busey, stay for Michael J. Fox.
Right. Oh, man. What is that? Talk about a life lesson in that. But yeah, like, if we get out of here actually soon, I might go see Used Cars. That's tonight.
Yeah, got to.
They played Flight last night, which is a super underrated movie.
Never seen.
I love
Flight. With Denzel Washington. With
Denzel, yep, and
plays an alcoholic in that too, right?
Yeah, yeah. I like the alcoholic and the addiction story. So
I mean, I don't say that kind for of any a reason. Then, like, I just kind of remember that about these movies, even though I haven't seen them.
That's the thing about Zemeckis. I mean, he's like. He's almost like a De Palma on a bigger budget level. It's like he's hard to define, and he kind of has a style, but he could still work it within like kind of mainstream projects. And I mean, Zemeckis's name isn't up there with Spielberg, but in terms of like his cultural relevance and the movies that he's been making since the late 70s, I mean, he's definitely up there.
Yeah.
And they're playing all three Back to the Futures on Sunday. Forrest Gump, which is a fucking crazy movie. Like, the older it gets, the more insane of like what a boomer wank fest that movie was, even though like I saw it when I was like seven. So it's like, it's just that was for me such an interesting movie. Like, I saw the movie when I was seven, so I had no understanding of like, this is, man, what like
boomer wank fest. I've never heard it put that way, but you're right. I mean,
it's 100%. I mean, that is 100% what that movie was like made to jerk off boomers in 94 and just everything they went through like the 60s and 70s. And,
right.
But like when I saw it when I was a kid, like I had no, like it was largely like how I like was introduced to like a lot of cultural milestones. And just learning, sure. Kind of like learning about like that
historically, how, yeah.
Obviously, it was like, you know, it was a fictional character, but like that it was based on things that actually happened,
right?
Elvis and, you know, just everything in there.
We're talking about technology of putting him in those scenes and everything like that, which was really cool.
Kurt Russell playing Elvis in that movie. So, you know, if anything, there's that one. So,
and also the fact that, like, I mean, that swept the Academy Awards pretty much.
That's the other thing that's just crazy about Hollywood. It's like, this movie, that movie was like, people are obsessed with that movie. And like, now it's just viewed as just like an anomaly in Hollywood. It's like, it's just, it's a loaded film, I guess is a good way to put it.
Interesting.
But yeah. So Zemeckis at Music Box. That's all I got on regular random shit.
Well, I love it. Here we are. Great, another great episode. We'll finish it off with our music. All I can say is that by the next time we talk, we both better have seen Renfield so we can fucking gush on that shit. Gush. No vampire pun, you know.
Well, I'm not gonna jinx it, but you loved Air, so it's possible you're gonna hate Renfield.
Oh, don't go there. I mean,
yeah,
if it's comedy in the way that I think they might do it, where it's like a little bit more campy, I might not love that, but we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch. No. All right. So music pick, I'm going to go with this because the Lemonheads, I've been loving my whole life. And there's two records in particular that they've done that I just really, really, I mean, they're front to back. Perfect. It's Shame About Ray, which was like a 20-year anniversary last year, and they toured on that, and it was missed by me, and I'm sad about that. It's a shame that I missed that Shame About Ray tour. But this year, it's the 20th anniversary of their big album, which is like, you know, got that song Into Your Arms, which is like probably their biggest hit. Come On, Feel the Lemonheads from 93. So. They're going to be putting out like and they've been kind of teasing singles of like unreleased songs from it and, you know, like radio performances where they play it acoustic. And this song in particular, I want to talk about because I just really love, it's the fourth song called Down About It on this record. And it's like this and the song called Totally by Screeching Weasel are like kind of both integral in me understanding the low harmony. And I think I talked about the low harmony last time when we talked about Screeching Weasel, because my pick last week was Screeching Weasel. And there was a song called Totally on a record called Anthem by of a New Tomorrow that had these low harmonies where I'm like, wow, what is that? Like, how do you sing like that? This song in particular, in the second verse, has this great low harmony that he sings all the way through it. And I just love it so much. But it's a great song too. It's called Down About It. That's my pick. If you're out there listening, you got to check out this song. You got to check out this record. The record in general, fully front to back, is fucking perfect. And I can't wait for the 20th anniversary edition to come out. That's my pick of the week, man. What do you got?
Hell yeah. Love to get a little Lemonhead appreciation.
Are you a fan of them at all?
I mean, I certainly like them. I don't remember the last time I like put on one of their records actively, but
gotcha.
And I'm Into Your Arms. It's, I guarantee I've heard it, and I'm just trying to think of the melody.
I mean, I know a place where I can go when I'm alone. Into your arms, and whoa, into your arms. I'm sure you know that, yeah.
That was just my way of getting you to sing. So yeah. I knew the song sounded like, so that's
what I'm saying. Yeah, of course.
Everybody
just turned off the podcast.
Right? No, they're all thanking me. He's like, thanks, Patrick, for doing this. That's what they came here for.
Dude. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That's an awesome pick. So I'm looking forward to hearing it again, because so the song that you picked, I just added it to the list. That one I probably have not heard anytime recently. So
yeah, cool. I mean, if you get a chance and you got some time, that record I think you'd enjoy. Maybe it's good for like your run or something like that. There's a few like faster tunes in it, but most of it's pretty like it's laid back too, you know.
Oh yeah,
a little bit.
All right, awesome. So this is actually good, because you keep on getting synergy with our music picks. Is just lining up, for similar vibes. So the song and the band that I'm featuring, so the band The Clean from New Zealand.
Never heard.
Okay, so yeah, a loaded band for me. So they're from New Zealand. They started in the 70s, had a major compilation in 86. Because they were just kind of like an indie band that, you know, never like official releases, but they did have a compilation that came out in 86 that was kind of popular. Broke up and multiple times kind of throughout the late 80s and 90s. And I saw they had some reunions in like 2014 with some shows.
Oh, nice.
But very pivotal and influential indie band. You know, so their sound, as they kind of claimed, was highly inspired by Velvet Underground and the Ramones. So coming out of New Zealand in the late 70s and early 80s, they just kind of had a vibe that was influenced by that. But then looking forward, and with this, especially with the song that I'm picking today, which was just called Anything Could Happen, this song sounds straight out of the early 90s in terms of vibe. This specific song sounds a lot like Pavement, which is a band I love, heavy essential band from the 90s.
I mean, that's very arty, you know.
Yeah, and so I think they're just so the reason why I'm picking it is, so the original founding member actually just passed away. I came across Hamish Kilgore, one of the original founding members, died at 65, from New Zealand. And so I just wanted to kind of throw a little spotlight on them. So I came across The Clean by picking up one of their records based on somebody's recommendation who was working at the record store. I think it was Grimey's actually in Nashville. It was on one of my Southern road trips, which I love taking road trips to the South. It may have been in Atlanta. It was either in Atlanta or Nashville where I picked up one of the records. It was the compilation. It was entirely based on like talking to a couple of the people working there. I was just hanging out for a while, and somebody was just really, you know, based on all the music they were talking about, he was really suggesting I pick up this album.
A great story.
Yeah. And so this is, again, I doubt, I would have ever really come across them.
Yeah.
And certainly never like dove deep into like their compilation if it wasn't for like me picking it up from that physical.
Yeah, like New Zealand like music isn't really like crossed my radar or anybody's, I think, you know, without a recommendation, to be honest.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, so they got a little bit of, I mean, so this song actually has like 7 million hits on Spotify. So it's not like a super deep cut. I mean, this song is kind of a hit, you know, like on Spotify, which is more of like we're saying, more of like a contemporary gauge of like how popular a song is. So yeah, so like again, this is just another example of a band that like I mostly wouldn't have been familiar with if it wasn't for like, you know, hanging out at, you know, record stores and actually being able to talk to people.
Love basically that.
Just what why we're here talking about movies. So it's just one of those bands, and that specific album has stuck with me for many years. And this the connection between Velvet Underground to the 80s when this was produced. This song would have come out sometime in the early 80s. Like I said, it was on the compilation in 86. I didn't find a clear date of when it actually came out, but then sounding so much and feeling so much like a 90s song. And the lyrics are very 90s, very existential, looking for meaning, but then realizing there's no meaning in life and living in the present. I mean, that's the point of the entire song. Anything could happen, and it could be right now, is the chorus. And it's just, it so lines up with existentialism and Buddhism. You know, life is meaningless. Life has no inherent purpose, so it's up to you to create it. I love the lyrics, and again, like it just captures the vibe of the 90s and the sound way ahead of its time. So
I love that.
Yeah, so Anything Could Happen by The Clean on the compilation 86. Very catchy song. It's just like extremely catchy, so it's always been on playlist after playlist for me. So
kick ass. So, yeah. I'm glad it'll be on our Remainders podcast jukebox.
Hell yeah. So like I said, synergy with these 90s vibes, keeping going.
Lemonheads, well with the Lemonheads. So yeah, The Clean. All right, great. Well, I really feel like we spent a lot of time talking about a lot in this episode. If you're listening all the way through, thanks for sticking with us. And yeah, let us know. It was cool to talk about Don's comment about Lithgow. Like that's like what I would love to have a little bit more feedback from anybody listening so that we can talk about it, you know, next time we get together. Don, thanks for that comment. Man, we got to have you on the podcast one time. You know, I think maybe by season three, maybe we can invite some guests on, and it might be fun to, you know, have somebody else kind of come in for, you know, a spotlight. But in the meantime, if you're there and listening and you have some comments on Body Double, please leave them wherever you may be. YouTube, you know, we're all over the social medias and we do check it all the time just to see if anybody comments. And when you do, it does light up our life. So excited about what might come of people's thoughts on Body Double. Thanks for discussing it with me, Pat. And not next week, but the week after that, we will dive into our next film and talk to you guys then.
Awesome to talk to you. Looking forward to those Renfield texts. Thanks everyone for listening.
Yep, you got it. And hey, enjoy Zemeckis weekend if you get out this weekend.
Oh man, it's going to be wild. Michael J. Fox, always welcome.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Okay, we'll talk to everybody soon. Pat, signing off. See you next in 2 weeks.
See you, bud.